Hey, this is Joe Cornish.
Hello, this is Edgar Wright.
Yeah, and we're here to give you a special writer-director stroke executive producer commentary.
I've never been an executive producer before.
Was it exciting?
It was quite exciting.
I should explain, if it needs to be explained, that Edgar Wright is, of course, the writer and director of Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz and Scott Pilgrim versus the World. And I was very
You cunningly missed off my first film, Joe, there. Which
well,
something.
I did, because I don't know where you stand on that, Edgar Wright.
Well, we'll get into that, because this is your first film. I think this is what's interesting is, I think one of the things that I'm very happy to see with this film, and in my part as executive producer of helping godfather this film along in a small part, is that... you know, it's your first film, and there'll always be a first time, and I think you've done an amazing job with your debut feature.
Oh, thank you. But your debut feature,
not as
officially
good.
Speaking, no, is Fistful of Fingers, which
it's
had...
True.
Which, now, what year did you make that, Edgar?
I made it in 1994, and it came out in November 1995 in one cinema in London.
And what was the running time?
78 minutes long. How long is this, 98?
This is 88, yeah.
Okay, so it's 10 minutes shorter than a time block.
And what was your intention running time-wise for Fistful of Fingers?
Here's the truth, and I think, I don't know whether, we can talk about this, because hopefully there'll have been all the anecdotes about the production on the other commentary, so we can get into some deeper stuff about first features, but I seem to remember that you had a slightly similar problem during the production, and we could talk about this, is, I mean, generally, like, there's nothing wrong with a 90-minute feature, and as far as I'm concerned, there's nothing wrong with an 80-minute feature.
Mm.
You know,
well, a lot of the...
Classic B-movies.
Well, a lot of my favourite films are a lot shorter than I remembered when I started looking into this. Run, Lola, Run is shorter than Attack the Block.
Yep.
Evil Dead 1 and 2 are shorter than Attack the Block. Stand By Me, Paths of Glory. There's a long list, Spinal Tap. There's quite a long list of really satisfying feeling movies that are surprisingly short.
It's a good list that has Paths of Glory and Spinal Tap next to each other. No, what's interesting, and this happens with a lot of first films, and what happened with my first film is that I wrote it, I think maybe the script was 80 minutes long. We'll get back to Attack the Block in a second, because it does come back to you. But it was the assembly edit. For those of you who don't know what an assembly edit is, it is when you put every shot in the film end to end, pretty long. So it's kind of the longest version of the film.
So and the editor kind of tries to use every single angle, right? Or at least minded, so that you can see all the choices you've got.
Yeah, so as comparison, Hot Fuzz, which is a 2-hour movie, the assemble edit was like 2 hours, 40 minutes long. Fistful of Fingers, which is now runs 78 minutes, the assemble edit was 74 minutes long.
Whoa.
There wasn't enough stuff. And what ended up, which is my thing that I'm, this is turning into a Fistful of Fingers commentary.
It's interesting though.
But what, I remember, same thing happened to you, is I remember halfway through the shoot, you had there was a worry about the running time, which I wasn't concerned about at all, because I was thinking, well, anything from 80 to 90 minutes is absolutely perfect for a first film, and this kind of film as well.
I guess I got neurotic while we were shooting the action, which we did fairly early in the schedule, because, you know, it takes a long time to shoot, and then when you compress it down, it doesn't occupy much screen time.
Yeah.
So we got over that worry pretty quickly once we were through the action and back into the drama. But yeah, there was a moment when I thought, man, are we going to have enough material? Because the bottom line, really, with filmmaking, whether it's your first, and I assume, you know, all through your career, is you have a limited window of time, you have a huge amount of ambition, you prepare as much as you possibly can, but it is a race, isn't it? It's a race to shoot every angle you need and get enough material and shoot each location before your permission to shoot there runs out. Do you know what I mean? So there's often very little flexibility in...
Well, you said something a couple of times, which I think absolutely sums up the making of a first film, is you said, you know, you've got years to think about it and 5 minutes to screw it up on the day.
I had no idea how what the deal is with that or was with that, you know, and as much as you have brilliant people around you, and God knows I had amazing people around me on this crew, stuff goes wrong. There's just stuff you cannot control, whether it's the weather or just human beings or outside influences. And so however brilliantly you plan, you always end up having to improvise and think on your feet and compromise a bit. But I suppose that's what's significant about Fistful of Fingers. It is Edgar's first film, is that that was a big lesson you learned, right?
And
you,
yeah. And one of the biggest lessons I learned, and I think one of the things that, you know, I guess my part in this film, be fair to say, during the shoot, I wasn't really around a lot because I was editing Scott Pilgrim, but I was, you know, sort of there to kind of mentor you before, like, you know, during in the edit and certainly afterwards. And I think one of the things that we talked about a lot, and one of the problems that I had with my first film, and I've sort of made like a mental note never to let it happen again, is make sure you've got enough coverage to pace the movie.
Right.
Because the problem with my first film, one of the reasons that it was 74 minutes long, I wanted it to be faster. I actually wanted it to be faster, but I didn't have anything to cut to. And so pretty much every single shot was in there. And there was only one shot in the whole film that I thought was so appalling, it had to go. And even then the producer was saying, oh, but that shot's 30 seconds long. It's a shame to kind of let that go.
Wow.
So it was a painful experience because I couldn't really pace it up.
I do remember it coming out, Fistful of Fingers. It had a small theatrical release, didn't it? In London, certainly,
you
right?
You couldn't say it was released in cinemas because it was released in cinema. It was in one screen, the Prince Charles, where you had a great Attack the Block Q&A the other day.
We did, yeah. Great cinema, the Prince Charles, here just off Leicester Square in London. But we should also say that, you know, listeners, Edgar and I have been friends for like about 10 years. Our TV shows were on at the same time.
I think 12 years.
12, cool. Our TV shows, my Adam and Joe show and Space, just about overlapped on a UK TV station called Channel 4. And we met in a DVD shop browsing for DVDs and became friends. And so
in the cinema store, let's get a name check. Maybe they'll give us some free DVDs.
And I've been lurking around Edgar's company and observing what he does and how he does it, secretly making notes for 12 years. So as a result, this is...
Sometimes I wake up in the night and just saying...
I'm standing there in a Burberry Mac. Anyway, so that's why Edgar's, you know, whether he likes it or not, had a lot to do with, you know, my movie-making brain.
I was very happy to help. And it's funny, like, I've had responses to this movie. You know, when we had that screening in LA, a lot of fellow directors that came to the screening that I held in LA said, wow, what an amazing debut. And I said, and I don't think this is fair to say, I said, that you've been, you know, waiting to make a movie for, like, over 20 years.
So absolutely.
It's something that kind of, it's not, as far as I'm concerned, it's not come out of the blue.
No, there's a lot of pent up, I've had movie blue balls for 20 years, and this is a big celluloid ejaculation. I'm seeing the logo of my movie company there.
I think that's the new Paul quote that should be on the DVD. Was it a painful orgasm or was it a pleasurable orgasm?
It was sustained. It was a sustained. Yeah, and let's move on anyway. This is a revolting metaphor.
Well, to go here's the thing that's interesting. The other links that me and Joe have is that you know, we both. Well, we both started in TV, but we actually kind of both had wanted to be directors since we were teenagers. Mm. And we'd also both gone to the same art college, not at the same time and not on the same course. But I think it's also fair to say, I mean, I guess I've always done, even when I used to make films as a teenager, I'd always done comedy films. Although part of that was because I lived in Somerset and I just didn't really have the... I almost like didn't have the balls to do anything serious.
Right.
But you kind of started out doing, you know, your kind of first shorts and stuff were not comedy. Is that right?
At film school they weren't comedy, but the first stuff I ever put on film was with Adam Buxton when we were at school together on Super 8. I had a Super 8 camera with a sound stripe and everything down the side. And we made a 10-minute film called A Few Friends for Dinner. and it was sort of like a little Tales of the Unexpected thing. No, it was about this really posh family, and Adam played the mum in drag, and we shot it in the school library and dressed it up as like a big dining room of a posh house.
Now, was it shot in... You live close to this area. Was that film shot anywhere near here?
No. That was shot in Westminster in our very posh school. We did all our stuff at school, Adam and me, and then we made a 1-hour film that was called Twitch of the Death Nerve, which is an homage to the famous Mario Bava film, aka
Carnage, aka Bay of Blood.
And I was so excited about doing it. It had Louis Theroux as a police officer, and Adam was his boss. And it was a sort of modern reworking of Sweeney Todd, and it went on for an hour.
When are we doing the DVD copy on that one? I want to see it.
And I screened it at school. About 5 people turned up, and I made myself a special baseball cap because I thought that would be fun, and I wrote the name of the film on it in Tippex, but I misspelt it, so it said Twith. So I went I went around at school for several weeks with a hat saying Twith on it. I don't think anyone knew. Everyone thought I was mad.
Twith of the Death Nerve.
Twith of the Death Nerve, that would have been.
Twith of the Death Nerve?
Yeah.
Okay, that's got to be... If somebody's out there who fancies doing one of those fake Criterion covers, can you do one for Twith of the Death Nerve by Joe Cornish? What year?
That would have been probably about 1985.
Stick it on IMDb. But those, Twitter the Death Nerve, 1985, Joe Cornish.
Those were my first works. And then when I went to film school, I made some quite serious, pretentious movies that I don't really want to talk about ever again.
But it's all character building.
It is, yeah.
You know, it's interesting. It's interesting, just I think the path that we both kind of came to into making movies, and it's interesting... You know, we both have the Channel 4 Film 4 connection because I think actually, weirdly, there are extra connections between the two of us because I think through Joe, I think we met in 99 and around that time, I certainly met a few people that I'm still friends with and have been colleagues through you and Adam, like Jim Wilson, who produced this film. I'm pretty sure I first met through you and you guys already knew Jim, and I think then me and Simon went in to meet Jim to talk about Shaun of the Dead. In 2001, after... Oh, no, maybe before 2001. In between Space Series 1 and 2 is when we first started thinking about that. So around, like, 99 is when the first rumblings of that film happened.
It's one of the nice things about getting a tiny bit older, because I felt very much like an outsider when I was in my teens and 20s. And I spent a lot of time very frustrated and thinking I was being shut out and feeling you're in a catch-22 situation back then, because... The industry was quite unionized, and you couldn't get union accreditation unless you had a job, but you couldn't get a job unless you had union accreditation and stuff. But what you don't realize is a lot of people who are the same age as you will get into the industry too, and suddenly by the time you're about 30, people you've known for 10 years are suddenly often in quite good jobs around you in the industry, aren't they?
Yeah.
And like people I knew at film school, like I was at film school with Chris Dickens, who edited...
Shaun of the Dead, and won the Oscar for Slumdog Millionaire.
Yeah, and you know, I remember him shotgunning beers, you know, aged 18 in a Bournemouth back garden. So it's
hair as well, presumably.
Yeah. So the moral of that story is stick with your friends, isn't it? And if people are serious about doing it when they're 18, there's every possibility that they will be doing it when they're 28 or 38.
Yeah, I had this... Well, here's a funny thing, because I wonder whether you had any view on this. And when I made Fistful of Figures when I was 20, almost my sole reason for doing it was because I'd heard these stories about people like Sam Raimi, like starting Evil Dead at age 18.
Right, and Rodriguez.
And Rodriguez. I think Rodriguez was after the fact, because I don't think I saw El Mariachi until I'd done Fistful of Fingers.
But that was... And was that around the time of Kevin Smith coming on the scene as well?
That was also afterwards. You know what's funny? I remember having made Fistful of Fingers and sitting in the edit suite and it being very difficult. We basically didn't have any money to edit the film, and we edited it in a broom cupboard in Pinewood.
Hmm.
So it was both kind of glamorous and distinctly unglamorous at the same time. But... trying to make this comedy western like on like £11,000 budget, and I remember vividly reading about Clerks in like Screen International and thinking, oh, God, that sounds so simple. I look at this, he's just made a film in a shop and it's doing really well. Why didn't I think of that? But what I was going to ask was, I was completely spurred on by this idea of making a film at that age. And I desperately wanted to do like My Bad Taste or my kind of Evil Dead.
Uh-huh.
And then when I made the movie, I'm being very hard on Fist of the Fingers, but when I made the movie in the edit, I kind of realized that I'd not done that. And also that I remember having an existential crisis about the fact that I'd committed something to film.
Huh.
That was very...
Well, it is a weird process, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's this...
'Cause there's no going back once you've done it.
No, and there's this thing people say that you make three films, right? You write the script. There's the script that you write. Then there's the film that you shoot. And then there's the film that you release. Mm. And I couldn't really work out what people meant by that until I did it. The thing is that it kind of changes, doesn't it? Like, you will never be able to shoot exactly what you envisaged in your head when you wrote it.
No, absolutely.
So you have to be a bit prepared to be a bit malleable with the material as you go along to try and shore up its strengths and mitigate its weaknesses and stuff. And I guess that's the thing, isn't it? Your relationship to what you shoot changes as you work on it. You know, material, it's different standing in the room on the set than it is when you get into an editing room and see it on the screen.
Yeah.
So I don't know what I'm saying with all this, but I can totally see that you would have an ambition, you would shoot it, and then you would get to the editing room and you'd think, shit, this is something different from what I expected, and then start to feel panicky. No, that did not happen on Attack the Block, luckily, but I can totally see how easily it could happen.
Well, I think that's the thing, is that in my case, I think it was more the fact that I realised I'd made a film that was pretty kind of silly and lightweight. And there was nothing really necessarily wrong about that, but it was more, I remember that I'd only really done two drafts of the script. I remember, I was haunted by... In the edit, I was haunted by new ideas. That was the worst thing.
Yes.
That I would be...
Thinking of better ways to do stuff.
Yeah. I mean, did you have that on this? I mean, you had a chance to rectify some stuff, didn't
we
you?
We did. We did some pickups. So, no, I don't think so. I think... nothing major. No, you always think of fun lines you could have put in or little ideas, but there's that other cliche of filmmakers never finish films, they just get taken away from them.
Yeah.
Which is true as well, because in the editing process, you realise there's so much scope for adjusting and improving in post.
Yeah.
The editing's incredible. You know, obviously I'd done a lot of it before, but never at this level. And the way you can change the energy of a scene just by holding on a particular character for a second longer.
Yeah.
You can change the meaning of a whole scene depending on who you're... cutting to, like if it's two people talking, you could cut to someone watching them and then the scene would be about the person watching them.
Yeah.
And it was really magical how much we could do. So that's kind of how I felt. I felt that I could have used another month in the cutting room and equally in the mix. But all filmmakers say that, and there comes a time when you just run out of money and you've just got to cut your losses and get the thing out there kind of thing.
I think it's also interesting. I mean, definitely in the edit, there's also that kind of... butterfly effect, not just because there was a moth on screen. There's that butterfly effect where you could change something in an earlier scene and it can have ramifications like an hour later.
Yeah.
And that's something else we should mention about this film, which is interesting, is that we were editing next door to each other because Scott Pilgrim and Attack the Block overlapped.
That's right.
John Amos, who edited Attack the Block, had been editing Scott Pilgrim with me and Paul Matchless. There was like Paul Matchless and John Amos were doing it as a team. And then we got to a point with Scott Pilgrim where John was able to go literally next door and start editing your movie. So there was a point, I think maybe after Christmas 2009, that you were in the next door edit suite and I could hear Attack the Block through the wall whilst I was editing Scott Pilgrim. And presumably you could hear Scott Pilgrim as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was brilliant to get Jonathan Amos, who's a brilliant editor, but to get him straight off Scott Pilgrim. And you know, he must have been deep in action rhythms and, you know, in cutting a movie like that to get him onto this movie, because he's cut the action brilliantly here, I think. I'm really...
Oh, yeah, it's great.
Really,
actually, this is one of my favourite sequences, actually. I think that I love the score in this bit, and I love the editing here.
This is shot on a tiny handheld 35mm camera. Those kids running down those stairs, I think, and the operator Julian Mawson couldn't see what he was shooting because it was so small, and he just held it in one hand and sort of improvised following the kids down, and we just grabbed what we could.
I like Simon Howard talking to his mum. He looks so innocent here. I promise.
But what other things can we say about first films? I mean, I guess the thing... Can people see Fistful of Fingers, your first film? They can't, can they?
Not at the moment. It's on VHS, if you've got a VHS player.
Right, so you might find it on eBay. For cheapy cheap. Yeah. But there are so many... You know, I feel like... I feel so lucky to have been surrounded by a good crew, and basically, I feel lucky to have... Or I feel sensible to have waited for 20 flipping years. And
well, that's the question: is that would you have been able to make? You wouldn't have made this film 20 years ago.
No, I don't know what I would have done. I mean,
would you have made it 10 years ago?
I mean, the thing that frustrated me when I was younger, and I don't know whether you were like this, Edgar, but like if you look at back issues of Time Out, there's one or two letters in the 80s from a young. I used to write them in. Anonymously or under a pseudonym, complaining about how hard it was for short filmmakers to get into the industry.
Will you reveal the pseudonym or not?
I was called Sniper Hawkins.
Oh, I remember him.
And Sniper Hawkins wrote in the 80s some quite angry letters to some British publications.
Wait a sec, isn't Sniper Hawkins the director of Twitter the Death Nets?
Yeah, this is all...
So, but what did you say?
I said stuff like, you know... Oh man, I should have brought it with me. But you know, to cut a long story short, I was just in a sort of angry young man mood about the industry. And I guess in the early and mid 80s, when we were growing up, the British industry was quite dry. It was quite dominated by Peter Greenaway and Derek Jarman, who are obviously brilliant filmmakers. But me as a genre fan, I was hungry for that kind of stuff, and I didn't see it being made.
Well, when we were sort of growing up, in the 80s and for most of the 90s, there's kind of a lack of genre films. I mean, there's obviously some people that came through at that time, like Clive Barker and Richard Stanley and some others that I'm probably not mentioning. But, but what we knew from TV is that through the 50s, 60s and 70s, you'd had Hammer and Amicus and Tygon and all these British genre films that would be on TV all the time. And so I think sort of a lot of us grew up on those movies and then were kind of frustrated that they basically just weren't getting made anymore. The genre output in the 80s was very slim. There wasn't very many.
Mm. But I felt like I would never get into the industry, and I felt like I'd be an outsider forever. And I got a job in a production company. I was a production assistant on a movie called Blue Juice with Catherine Zeta-Jones and Sean Pertwee, which was a Film 4 production when I was probably about 24. And I remember being very excited to have a job.
Blue Juice has nothing to do with Blue Balls, right?
No.
We'll drop that metaphor completely now for the rest of the commentary.
But what I didn't anticipate is that just over time, and just by working, just by doing anything, just by not being snobby about what I did and just doing little things with teddy bears and just doing anything really, lo-fi comedy, that eventually it would be okay, you know, that I guess each generation sort of gets its opportunity, don't they? And sometimes you have to wait a bit for the decade ahead of you to pass. Do you know what I mean?
Well, do you find as well that having done the you know, the toy spoofs on Adam and Joe, and I certainly started doing kind of spoofs and pastiches and in TV, but by doing kind of pastiches, you actually get to analyse the movies themselves.
Yes.
I mean, your films, your toy films on Adam and Joe, the Adam and Joe show, are really brilliantly structured, and presumably you watch those films endlessly and took them apart. And it's like, you know, that when me and Simon were writing Shaun of the Dead, we would watch our favourite films and try and take them apart like a toy car, you know.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely what we did on those. That was one of the most pleasurable bits of it for me, was having an excuse just to watch the film I was doing 5 or 6 times and look really closely at the sets and stuff. These are little stuffed toy films I made, listeners. If you're not familiar with them, if you go to YouTube and put Adam and Joe in or toy movies in, you'll find these little parodies I used to do in the late 90s and early noughties. And yeah, they were very much a way to worship film, you know, and to analyze it, kind of thing, and to break it down.
Now let's talk about, like, you know, in the same vein, when you were kind of thinking about this film, because I know, like, you know, not only working on, but having been friends with you for 12 years, I know how long and hard you thought about this, and you know how painstaking your process was. What debut films, or what filmmakers and specifically debut films inspired you, or what things would you look at? I remember us having conversations about this actually in terms of the prep, but what people inspired you in terms of looking at their work and trying to figure out how to make this movie?
Well, I love low budget, high concept movies, and there were a lot of them around in the 80s. And I particularly like low-budget, high-concept movies by first-time directors. I'm thinking of Spielberg's Duel,
yep,
which again was a TV movie, but is incredibly cinematic, even though it's like 4x3 and...
shot in 11 days.
Right, craziness. Very limited budget, very limited schedule, but it's almost like a silent film, Duel.
Yeah.
And it's such an unusual thing for a director to do with a TV movie. Even though it's not his very first film, his very first film was Piranha 2 Flying Killers, a.k.a. The Spawning.
What are you talking about? Spielberg?
No, Cameron. I'm about to move on to Cameron.
Oh, I see, right. I thought you were still talking about Spielberg.
No, that was a segue into Cameron, because I'm about to say Terminator.
Yep.
So, because it's not officially his first film, but in some ways it is, because Piranha was a job for hire, wasn't it? For
Terminator is his debut, like Shaun of the Dead is my debut.
Yeah, there you go. But Terminator's an amazing first film. Yeah. Just incredible. Ridley Scott's The Duelists, I often think about, which is a really good genre movie. You know, there's lots of them. These sort of directors who bite off more than they can chew, and they have to be a bit inventive to get something that can compete with bigger budget movies, really. And then the other most important influence on Attack the Block is... John Carpenter and Assault on Precinct 13 in particular, Escape from New York and The Thing, and Halloween, weirdly.
Mm.
Just because he's like a consummate, high-concept, low-budget filmmaker. He comes up with an idea that's an amazing kind of one-liner, just a situation that has a very simple setup that then is like a clockwork toy. You just wind it up and let it go, kind of thing.
Well, the other thing with it, funny enough, I mean, I'm a huge John Carpenter fan as well, and Assault on Precinct 13 I love. And in fact, it was on BBC One the other day, and it was one of those great things where it was on late night on BBC One on a Friday night, and I was thinking, oh, wow, this is like
that's good,
the
80s. It? That's good, and you sort of fantasize about lots of kids seeing it for the first time, like turning on their TV and seeing
Let's stress the 1976
film.
Version of Assault on Precinct 13. Mm. But what's interesting about John Carpenter, and Walter Hill has this as well, who I know you love too, but
yes,
John Carpenter, they don't have the budgets, but he has the big ideas, and also kind of quite grand... shooting style on a low budget, like Assault and Precinct 13 and Halloween. They're shot in 2.35. They're extremely low budget, but they're shot in scope.
Mm.
And, you know, they have kind of really cinematic... It might be... They have kind of big canvas compositions on a small budget.
Mm.
And the thing's really interesting about Assault and Precinct 13 is how well... constructed it is and how well composed, and also he has the confidence in his setups, you know, that I think sometimes when you can tell a filmmaker that is less confident, there tends to be a lot of coverage, or there isn't really any rhyme or reason to the construction
of the
scene,
isn't it? I mean, you're right, he shares that with Walter Hill. It's really economical, and I suppose because you don't have maybe as much time to kind of faff around when you're making a film on a low budget, you have to be 100% sure that every setup counts,
yeah,
and every line counts, and every scene is contributing to the story. You can't really shoot scenes that you don't think you'll use, can you?
No.
So, and I thought about that when I was writing my script. I knew that every moment on the set would be precious, so I worked very hard to make every scene move the story forward, and that was and both Walter Hill and John Carpenter really inspired me in that way because of how economically they drive their stories. And you're right about the framing as well. There's something wonderful about those films being in quite small locations, isn't there? Like Halloween in just one neighborhood, The Thing in that one ice station, Assault on Precinct 13 just in the police station. Yet he's shooting them in these small spaces in widescreen. So it's sort of, you leave the cinema and it makes your daily life feel kind of cinematic.
Yeah.
And it makes just being in your house feel cinematic. You feel, oh man, there could be a chase up that staircase, or who's in that room that I don't know about. It makes sort of banal things seem more dramatic because you're applying a sort of blockbuster visual language onto an intimate scenario kind of thing.
Well, what's also a good link between John Carpenter and Walter Hill and this film is also a real sense of geography. And yes. I know that's something that you thought long and hard about.
Well, I'm a massive fan of Die Hard. And when I was at Die Hard came out when I was at film school. And at the time, I was going through quite a pretentious stage of being into Louis Malle.
What was your hair
and
like?
And Truffaut. greasy and long.
Was there a foppish fringe element to it?
Definitely a lot of flinge flicking going on. and then I saw Die Hard and it kind of blew me away. It seemed more sophisticated than all the European stuff I was seeing. Because at the time I was obsessed with trying to learn how to write proper screenplays, and I was reading all those books and I did the McKee course and stuff like that.
Ironically though, if you listen to John McTiernan's commentary for Die Hard, him and Yann de Bont were like all inspired by Euro photography. In terms of the kind of the setups in Die Hard, they talk a lot about how the unmotivated kind of like crane is something that was in European films but not in Western films.
Wow.
Pre-Die Hard.
I don't think I've ever listened to that commentary.
It's a good one.
I should do. But I just thought Die Hard was an incredible use of a location. I still feel like I could go to the Nakatomi Plaza, and I know it's a real building in LA, but
we drove past it the other day, didn't we?
We did. So I can't frame this story with the idea that I've never been there, because I have been there. But even before that, I felt like...
We haven't been on the roof.
No, but you feel like you know the geography, don't you?
You
feel like you know where the front is, where the back is, where the reception is, where the lifts are, just by seeing the film. And it's one of these movies that walks you through a location in an innocuous mood. And not dissimilar to Sean in some ways, the way Sean's journey in the morning to go to the newsagent then repeats.
Yeah, it's like a setup for later.
Yeah, Die Hard does that as well. You visit all these locations and you don't know what their significance will be later. But then in the second half of the film, you revisit them all and they're turned upside down or inside out in some crazy way. And that was very much what we did in this film. You know, you visit every location that the kids are chased through later in the first 15 minutes, and then we try and do something interesting with each location, whether it's the big fight in Tears Flat, or the smoky corridor, or the corridor becoming full of smoke, or this stuff here in the underground garage. I was just very inspired by Die Hard with that kind of thing.
Tell us about the map that you drew for the movie and what that was inspired by.
That was, there. If you go to South London, and maybe this is the same the world over, you get these sort of tin plate maps on the edge of estates that show, so you can figure out where your mate lives.
I can confirm it's the same in North London.
I was looking for anything in this milieu that felt like science fiction or felt like old school fantasy and adventure. And it seemed to me those tin plate maps were similar to the maps you get on the inside of Tolkien novels, like the map of Middle-earth in Lord of the Rings. And if you just change the mundane names of all the houses to something fantastical, you'd end up with this sort of fantasy adventure terrain. But there were lots of things.
So if Brixton is Bag End, where's Mordor?
Mordor, I don't know, Mordor Street. I don't know, maybe it's...
We're close to Mordor Street right now.
We are. But that was the idea, was to find all these science fictional things in this environment that's usually used for quite downbeat social realism. So these bikes reminded me a little bit of the speeder bikes in Jedi, and obviously the BMXs in E.T. The costumes they wear there reminded me of ninjas or bandits. They felt like they're out of a, you know, a Japanese samurai film or a Western or something. And also, that obviously reminded me of 70s American gang movies like The Warriors, or 80s gang movies like Rumblefish and The Outsiders. And
well, let's just, whilst you're on that tip, we'll come back to that in a second, but tell us a little bit about, talking about the, you know, The Warriors and Walter Hill.
Mm.
You know, tell us about your work with Tom Townend, the DP, because there's your kind of colour palette in this is very different to what you sometimes get in British films.
Yeah, we wanted to make a special effort to make it colourful. We tried to make it like a 70s Disney film with saturated colours, like a comic book. And the costume designer was involved in this, and obviously Marcus Rowland, the...
What specifically the Disney set films designer, in the 70s? I want names.
I was watching, weirdly, Mary Poppins.
Oh.
And you look at Mary Poppins, and it's there's something about the film stock then. It almost looks like a cartoon now.
Can I be a film pedant and say that's a 50s Disney film?
Oh, good man. What did I say, 60s?
You said 70s.
There you go. Oh, damn, that's bad.
That's okay. Well, what, the 70s one, you could have had Watcher in the Woods.
Yeah,
Maybe that's 1980.
Well, that's a very good example, maybe. Watcher in the Woods. Like Pete's Dragon, those ones that mix, Bedknobs and Broomsticks that mix animation. 50s. This is the deal. Okay. I made a big fucker.
No, 50s. It's okay. I might be wrong. Bedknobs and Broomsticks might be 60s, actually.
You're very good at film dates. I'm bad at dates.
I'm good at dates before 1994. Then as soon as I started working, I can't... Anything in the noughties, I couldn't tell you what
really?
They were. The noughties, anything past like 99.
I'm the opposite. I'm
but
good at
pre 95. I'm good because I used
good 80s,
to memorize
80s onwards.
I used to memorize the Lennon Moulton's Guide.
Really?
But I stopped doing that in like.
What do you mean memorize it? Sit like. On
I would
the toilet.
Sit and read it. I know things. I know reviews of films that I've never seen.
Wow.
Which is why I'm good on that Doug Loves Movies game. But after 95, I'm terrible.
But yeah, the idea definitely was to look at movies where animation blends with live action, like those 50s Disney movies, Bedknobs and Broomsticks, Pete's Dragon, because basically part of our creature technique is to blend animation with live action. And that was always the idea. We make our aliens by shooting a creature in camera, then using a rotoscope technique that takes out the reflection of their fur. So from very early on, I talked to Tom Townend, the DOP, about how that would work, and how we could make a creature that's essentially two-dimensional blend into three-dimensional spaces. And we knew we had to design the whole thing as if it was 2D comic book panels and try and make fields of shadow and blackness and darkness in all the shots that the creature could emerge from. So we wanted to make it very high contrast, which is a John Carpenter thing as well, particularly in the film The Thing.
Yeah.
Beautifully shot. Particularly stuff shot at night, and The Thing is my favourite, one of my favourite nighttime movies, just because there is such clarity and you can see everyone's faces and there's brightness and darkness in every frame, and the contrast range is really strong. And it's the same in The Warriors, which was shot by Andrew Laszlo on a pretty low budget, incredibly inventively.
And on a short schedule, and on summer nights as well.
Amazing. And in fact, that's one of the first things that really impressed me when I met Tom Townend, the DOP. We were talking about The Warriors. We were talking about American films of that period and how they had have a particular sort of greeny-blue. They have a different colour than contemporary nighttime films have. And it was about the third thing Tom said to me. He said, oh, yeah, that's because the municipal streetlight in New York used to be mercury vapour and now it's sodium.
and he was hired.
Yeah. he knew the date they switched the light, the type of bulb over. And yeah, that was that in the bag, job done.
Did you and Tom talk about other nighttime films?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We knew that this was a kind of thing that we wanted to do. Blade Runner,
yep,
all set in the dark. Streets of Fire, vast majority set in the dark, very famously shot in a huge sort of canvas
soundstage
tent, I think.
That's right. At the same time as Blade Runner, maybe. No, something else. What was shooting next door to Street? Maybe Gremlins was shooting next door to Streets of Fire. I think so.
Yes, so Assault on Precinct 13 obviously starts in daylight, but then most of the action takes place at night. Die Hard starts in daylight, takes place at night. I mean, all these movies really connect back to Rio Bravo, don't they? That's the classic siege movie that was then flipped by Romero for Night of the Living Dead.
Rio Bravo has less siege stuff than people remember. It's funny.
But that's what inspired Night of the Living Dead, right?
Yeah, it's mostly the climax of Rio Bravo. Like, Rio Bravo, like, it's funny because I actually saw Rio Bravo after Assault and Precinct 13, and I'd kind of been led to believe that it was like the Western version of Assault and Precinct 13, which it only part of it. It's like, but it's interesting how that element of like the siege in that Western, which is much more expansive than that, has inspired so many films like Night of the Living Dead, Assault and Precinct 13, and others.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of inspired that single location under attack, right? That has then developed into this big trope that's sort of survived and grown and for years and years. Because it's that sort of Shaun of the Dead is coming a bit from Night of the Living Dead. And then obviously this, and then Die Hard and, you know, this movie, single location under siege.
Well, another one, like, in that vein, which was an inspiration on Shaun of the Dead, which is a similar aspect, is Straw Dogs.
Yes.
Which is a sort of huge nighttime siege. I mean, it's always that idea, and it's similar
to
this.
And Hot Fuzz, presumably, with the idea of the town conspiring against the...
But more the idea of, like, sort of a location becoming somebody's castle. It's like they're going to defend their castle.
I know. I love that. I think that's a very... I mean, that connects my film with that great masterpiece, Home Alone, as well. Because...
Very similar.
It's that childhood wish fulfillment thing, and I think it's a fantasy you can easily have as a kid, isn't it? Like when your parents go out for the night and you're left with the babysitter and suddenly your whole house is your terrain kind of thing.
Well, that's similar to both, and then also similar in a weird way to... Dawn of the Dead has that aspect as well, of like sort of defending, you know, running amok in a mall. What if you had a whole shopping mall to yourself? Yeah. How quickly would that excitement pall?
Yeah.
And the same with Shaun of the Dead is like sort of the 20-somethings in that is their idea of the perfect place to be forever is a pub.
Absolutely.
And you get the sense that he might want to stay there forever.
But the nighttime thing was really important, mainly because I was very keen for this to look like a Hollywood movie as much as we could pull off for the budget. And I thought that shooting it all at night... would like, obviously, narrative wise it creates a pressure cooker situation, and it creates a moment to moment narrative where you don't really have to deal with exposition, you can just deal with the moment, which is better for me, but also means you have to think about light in every single shot. And poor old Tom and his sparks really couldn't sit and sunbathe at all, because every single shot they had to think about light, and we tried to put light everywhere we could in the film. There's little lights in the little boy's shoes, obviously in the creature's teeth. And Tom and I really talked about exploiting any opportunity we had to use practical light. Because one of my pet theories was that lighting, for me, is about light sources in the frame as much as it's about light set up off camera.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So the strip lighting in the corridors, obviously, we did a huge amount with. The little windows above the doors in the corridors where... the light from inside people's apartments goes into the corridors was very important. You know, the lights in the lift, lights in costumes, in the animals.
Well, it feels very naturalistic. You don't ever feel in this that you're in a set, which is great. The lighting is fantastic.
Yeah, even though we are. In fact, all the interiors are sets built by Marcus Rowland. Did a very good job. And he did a good job as well, I think, of not making this block look like a shithole, you know?
Yeah.
In a lot of British movies... they just make tower blocks look like horrible, sort of deprived, graffiti-strewn crap holes, which they're absolutely not. We went, you know, we visited loads and loads in research for this movie, and a lot of them are very well cared for. You know, they're not necessarily super smart, but they're not, you know, the people are very proud to live in them, and they keep them very well. And so we wanted our block to look kind of lived in, but not like a horrible sort of crack den type shithole, because that wasn't true.
Now, to go back to the rotoscoping thing, there's a good shot there of Franz touching the monster. Explain to me, well, I know what this story is, but explain to me to the listeners, is the Lord of the Rings connection to that?
Yes, well, that was, the creatures were kind of inspired by the Ringwraith from Ralph Bashkey's Lord of the Rings, which I'm going to, now, can you date that one?
1979.
There you go. And I remember seeing that in London. I'm not even going to dare date anything ever again. I saw that in London, and then my mum and dad took me to an exhibition on a barge in the Thames all about the making of, and I remember they had a little, in one of the exhibits, they had a little film showing you how rotoscope worked. So what was that, 1979, did you say?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I would have been 10. And I remember it showed you them filming in a big white studio, these amazing guys in costumes, the Ringwraith, the Dark Riders on their horses trotting along. And then it showed you animators painting over the three-dimensional frame to flatten it out. And I was amazed by that process, how live action could become a cartoon. And I thought that was really fascinating, and it sort of stuck with me, really. And we kind of wanted to use the same technique here, and we kind of did. I felt it would be a good way to make the creatures present, but at the same time not present kind of thing. I just thought there was a cool combination between the unrealism of animation and the reality of actually having a three-dimensional thing on the set. I was also weirdly inspired by the black cat I grew up with, because I used to have the same feeling with that cat. If you've got a black cat, amazing stuff happens with their fur. In bright sunlight, their fur looks brown. If you shine light directly at a black cat, it'll look almost white because the sheen is so bright. But then if you backlight a black cat, it will look like an absolute jet black silhouette. And that's what interested me, that in real life, here was a creature, a jet black creature, that if you backlit it, it actually looked like it was two-dimensional. And then when a backlit black cat starts to move, it looks as if this two-dimensional form is actually changing shape on a two-dimensional plane. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that was the idea for the monster, really, and we tested it very early on. Tom Townend came and shot a very primitive test of just a guy in a furry suit. We did about 6 months before we shot, and then we gave it to the effects company, Dineg, and they did a very simple test where they rubbed out the sheen on the fur, and we discovered if we put it in smoke and backlit it, we didn't even need to do that. You lost the sheen anyway. And so that dictated how we lit a lot of the scenes. We knew in the interiors we wanted shadows dark enough that the monster could come out of. And then in the exteriors we needed all that darkness, but it was also very important to make the contrast very bright and for it not to be a sort of murky, grainy, grim kind of shaky cam thing.
Well, what's interesting about the... We'll talk about the monsters a little bit, because what's interesting is that I think sometimes when people watch the film... And some people have even asked me, said, "Oh, how many shots of the monster CGI?" And I say, "Well, they're never fully CGI. There's augmentation to the jaws.
They're never more than 20% CGI."
But the interesting thing with it is, in terms of you had, maybe you can explain exactly what the suits were like. But one of the things I think is interesting about that, I don't know whether this was a factor. I mean, we're both big fans of physical effects. But there is also another factor here that if you did this movie with CGI creatures, I think you might not have got as good performances out of the kids.
Yeah, no, it was really important that they were there and jumping on the kids and smashing through windows and stuff. And plus, we couldn't really afford CGI creatures. Plus, I just feel, as a film goer, a bit bored of CGI creatures. They all seem to do the same things. They move amazingly, unrealistically fast. And they're kind of hyper-detailed. And I don't know, they seem very samey CGI creatures to me. So, yeah, I wanted to go the practical route. And, yeah, it was really good for the kids. It was frightening for them, and it meant they could really be chased, and they had something to perform to. And the guy we had doing it was amazing, this guy Terry Notary, who is a big Hollywood movement guy and creature movement guy. And he was really good. So yeah, I'm pleased with the creatures.
Give me some of Terry's credits. I know them, but for the listeners.
Viper Wolves in Avatar, Silver Surfer. I think we've mentioned this on other commentaries, actually. We've gone into Terry's CV.
Okay, forget
that.
IMDb. Forget it. Don't look on IMDb.
But yeah, but the creatures were there, and we enhanced them a little bit with digital work in post. And plus the rotoscope technique is done digitally, obviously. Yeah. But that for me is the thing to do. I'm a big fan of shooting whatever you can in camera. And that's for me how CGI should be used, to enhance physical things that are already there, to like tweak and enhance stuff that's in front of the camera wherever possible.
One thing that I've asked you this before. I'll do it for the record. But when I saw what the creatures looked like, I thought that maybe it was a reference to the logo of Space Invaders. Not the game, because obviously the game, the logo of Space Invaders and the actual game graphics.
But the illustration on the side of the cabinet.
Illustration on the side of the cabinet.
Definitely, yeah. No, it's like lots of things. My answers to questions all along the process of this film are amazingly long-winded, because I've got 25 years of stuff that I've stored up and put in this film. So everything has all these different, like, I can name you all those different things that have influenced those creatures, from my cat to Lord of the Rings to the wolf at the beginning of 300 to, exactly as you said, the Space Invaders illustration. There's an old SNES video game called Another World.
Oh, yeah.
There's the creatures in Bone. There's loads of things that were in my head that I thought would be cool to apply to this.
What are some of your... I'm going to get you to do another list. What are some of your favourite creatures in movies growing up?
Oh, man. Well, me and Adam Buxton, who's my comedy partner, we spent a lot of our teenage years going to movies, obviously bunking off school, going to films. And there's nothing we like more than a monster movie that withheld the monster, withheld it, then really had this big climactic scene where they revealed the monster. And the worse it was, the more we would like the film. There was this particular one with Donald Pleasance called The Kindred. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah.
That's got an amazing rubbery monster reveal.
A lot of big head monsters in the
80s. Yeah. Well, they build it up so much, so your expectations are so high by the time you get to the climax of the movie. And they've obviously given their monster guy a little cut of the budget and said, right, pull out all the stops, do something that's going to really freak people out. So in The Kindred, it's the most bizarre, surprising, rubbery, freaky mess. And it is funny. And there was a Hellraiser one that did that as well.
Hellraiser 2 Hellbound,
right,
has a big head monster,
yeah,
that comes out of the wall.
So we did.
Oh, it's going down a corridor, right?
It's chasing her down a corridor, is what I remember. Yeah,
chasing her down a corridor with a big head and kind of little, lizard arms.
Little lizard arms. My favorite creatures. I think my all-time favorite creature design is probably the amazing sort of white, shimmery, floaty wolf monster in Poltergeist.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's so weird. I think they shot it in a water tank.
And it only appears very briefly, right?
It appears very briefly. It's not really motivated.
It's a bit like Jack Skellington.
Yeah, cross between the big flying dog from The Neverending Story. it's like if The Neverending Story dog was anorexic and close to death. But it's such an unsettling, bizarre, random thing, and it doesn't connect with anything. And it's piteous as well. It's sort of tragic and elegant and sad.
Yeah.
But yet it's aggressive, and that really, really spooked me. I don't know why. Just because it was so odd. It was just so left of centre.
You know what's funny? I was at...
And that's an amazing film for practical effects, Poltergeist. It was made at that time when practical effects were at their peak, almost that, you know, they were pushing them as far as they could possibly go before digital then came in. And there's a period, what that would be very early 80s.
Yeah.
To mid 80s, when practical effects are really getting to their absolute pinnacle, aren't
they? Like Ghostbusters has very good practical effects.
Yeah.
Or not just that, but also the optical... Well, I guess that Slimer is a practical thing that's put on top, right? It's a puppet.
Well, that's the thing about those effects in those movies in those days. Everything was made, wasn't
it?
If it was a vista, like a wide shot of a fantasy landscape, some guy would have painted it.
Yep.
If it was a spaceship, it was a model, some guy would have built it. If it was a creature, it would be a puppet. And puppets, paintings and models are for kids. So however sophisticated these things were as a child going to the movie, you'd think, there'd always be a little hint in there that you could go home and try it yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
And that it was like a to quote my favourite Sandra Bullock film, it was a practical magic that you could that you could do yourselves, you know?
I thought All About Steve was your favourite Sandra Bullock film.
Yeah, you're right. I was just saying that for convenience. Maybe that's the same for the modern contemporary generation, for people like Gareth Edwards, or maybe they can now go home and do it on a computer. But certainly for me, I love physical things, and I love the idea that you might be able to go home and try it yourself, do it yourself.
Well, here's the funny thing. I don't know whether this was a big influence on you, but I, the other day, was around at Mark Gatiss's flat, who, you know, from The League of Gentlemen, who writes for Sherlock on Doctor Who, and he had an old Doctor Who magazine, a sort of compendium, and it was like an A to Z of the monsters. And as I was flicking through, and I used to have the same book when I was a kid, and it struck me that between the novelizations of Doctor Who and the photos from the show, they would always look great in still, and I would see monsters from episodes that I hadn't seen that were before my time, and think, wow, that looks so amazing. And then sometimes when you watch the episodes, them actually live action and walking is where they fall down.
Right.
Sometimes literally. But you know what I mean?
Yeah, the designs. Movement is massively important.
Yeah.
And let me get, that's again where this guy Terry Notary came in, whose entire craft is movement, studying the rhythm of an animal, the way its feet hit the ground when it runs, the way, just the biological mechanics of creatures he studies, and he can show you how just adjusting a rhythm in your movement will suddenly make you look like an animal. But yeah, so it's not only the design, is it? It's the way they move.
The big change in movies, I mean, in the sort of, especially in the sort of 50s and onwards, would be the sort of, you know, the man in suit films, and plenty of B-movies have like a big Tor Johnson type actor in a suit. But then the big change was Alien and the way that they did that and the amount of experimentation they went into that with, like finding the tallest, thinnest person they could.
Right.
Somebody that, they even tried the actor wearing the suit backwards, the idea of like the knees going the other way. So well, there's lots of experimentation that they tried.
And you and I talk a lot about a film called Extro.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a British, is it British Extro or American?
Yeah.
Yeah, a British, and you better do the dates again for this.
I think Extro, it's definitely after E.T., because it was promoted as being
the sort of
the antidote. So I think it's probably 1982 or 1983. It's definitely post E.T.
You know what? I've never seen it. I've only ever seen the photos and read about it.
I've seen bits of it. I've seen most of it late night on. I remember it was one of the. I never used to have a VCR when I was little, and so a lot of these films, which should have been my time, that were 18s or 15s, I never saw.
Weren't allowed to watch.
But I know Chris Cunningham is obsessed with Extro.
Right.
And I can kind of see it, because it's a very strange movie.
It's an alien movie, but the big thing with it is they've obviously thought about this. They've thought about how they can create a new paradigm in terms of creature suits. So they found a performer who could walk on all fours upside down, like a backflip, and then they designed the suit around a person doing an upside down backflip.
Yeah.
So they were immediately they freed themselves from the basic human physiognomy, which is always what you're trying to get away from, and what we try to cut around with our creature. If the back leg extended too much, it would immediately give away that it was a human leg.
Now, within the suits, how much extension is there on the arms?
There are arm extensions, but no leg extensions. The arm extensions are about, you know, the same length of the forearm again.
Because I don't think for a second when you're watching the movie that there are men in those suits.
Because their
arms are very long, and it just doesn't feel right.
Well, we work very hard.
If anything, the one thing it reminds me of, I'm going to throw out another one, and I think you know this one, is from Return to Oz.
Well, you've watched Return to... Tom Tanner watched Return to Oz the other day. I haven't seen it for a long time. I haven't seen it for a while either, but explain which creatures you're talking about.
I can't remember what they're called, the Roly Men.
Right.
They're not called the Roly Men.
And explain how they work.
Well, they were sort of rollerbladers on all fours.
Right.
Remember that they were kind of, they were...
And the other one is actually the Dark Crystal.
Yeah.
And what are they called?
The Skeksis?
No, the big, well, yeah, they were relevant. We looked at those
the
as well.
The big beetly ones.
The big things they ride, the massive sort of, they called Striders? They're big, and again, they were, when they made that film, they, according to the making of, they had circus performers with extremely long stilts. But then they weren't capable of running fast enough because they would trip over and they would break their limbs. So eventually the filmmakers had to have these huge, like, tram wires above the set and actually suspend the Striders like giant puppets.
Right.
And it became a huge nightmare. So I watched a lot of those 80s movies and watched the making ofs to see whether there were any clues about the problems they had. And yeah, there's amazing stuff on the Dark Crystal. Everyone looking really hacked off with the difficulties that they made for themselves with these creatures. So we got our guy, Terry Notary, involved at the very beginning of the process. He was there from day one with Spectral Motion, who designed the suit. And we made sure we designed everything with his comfort and ease of performance in mind. And it was a really good thing to do, and poor old Terry, it also meant that at no point could he ever blame the suit.
Right.
Because he'd had total 100% input in it, so. But he never did. He wasn't a complainer. He was amazing. You know, he went for it all the time.
Now, that's in the olden days, that would have been a miniature, but that's a digital Met?
That's more straightforward than it looks, perhaps.
Shot plates?
Yeah, the block is a plate, and then we built a green... We built sort of two floors of the block on green, what they call a green buck.
Yeah.
So we built a section of the front of the block in a studio. We painted it green against a green background. Then we only had two suits. We could only afford two monster suits in this film. So every time you see more than one creature, it's a cut, copy, paste effect, which again was another thing I thought about very early, because I like the idea of when two jet black two-dimensional forms met and they merged, you wouldn't know where one began and the other ended. It would become this kind of sea of nothingness, which I thought was cool. But yeah,
so... Sounds like you've observed black cats having sex. you don't know where one starts and the other ends.
That's a pleasure that lies in the future. I don't think I have. But... anyway, yeah, so that was...
There's probably a website for that.
Thanks. I'll check it out tonight. So, yeah, so that was quite a simple shot, all the creatures climbing up the block. But, again, amazingly executed by D-Neg, our effects people, and Ged Wright, who supervised that one.
But the two suits, or did you do one suit and just copy on, like, cut and paste on that, essentially? But they're climbing on what?
They're climbing on that green buck.
Right.
And then we just got them to climb in lots of different ways, and then you multiply it and stick it on top of the plate. But the thing that really made that particular shot work was the downlights that Tom had put on top of the block. We put those three or four very big, powerful lights in very sort of sharp relief that brought out the exterior of the block, because we wanted to make it look like a spaceship. So those lights are sort of ostensibly the engines blasting it along.
And then that was one of your things, that the block should look like...
The block should be the Nostromo,
basically.
And, so those downlights and the shadows that those creatures create were the thing that really bonded the plate with the element that we shot.
No, the real counter blocks don't have those lights at the top, is that right?
No, they don't. I don't think so. Certainly not that
bright. It's outrageous. I don't like the film anymore.
It's a lie, tissue of lies. Now notice here, Jerome has his school uniform poking out there. He's the one character who has done a good day's schoolwork and just pulled his jacket on.
I know, but no. And what are you saying? He pays the price any second now. What are you saying about doing your homework?
I'm not saying anything. I'm saying I'm happy that apart from obviously Moses, and it's important to say that Moses brings this entire evening on himself. If he hadn't mugged Sam, I don't think that alien would have come down from the sky. He sort of wishes it down in a sort of fairy story way by mugging her. Everything that happens is a consequence of that action, because he kicks in the little creature, and so everything that happens is caused by that one bad action by Moses. So hopefully everyone appreciates it's quite a moral film. And then...
And it sets him up... It sets it up for... That he has to... Yeah, he is responsible.
He realises responsibility. He returns the stuff he's stolen. He's too proud to actually directly apologise. But he tries to redeem himself by his action at the end. But anyway, all that aside, the deal is that people in this film aren't punished for, like, little moral transgressions like a Stalk and Slash. And I love Stalk and Slash movies. I love all the Friday the 13th movies.
All of them?
I kind of do, because I saw them at the right age, and they freak me out.
I go 1 to 4.
I know you're
six.
Yeah, right.
Then maybe that's it.
Once again, you've got a more evolved numerical approach to the information.
1 to 4, 6, and then maybe.
Two is my favourite.
Two is your favourite.
Yeah, and I still.
Four's the good, but four's the one with.
I used to have the 3D poster in my
Corey
in my
Feldman,
bedroom.
Like,
and four's terrific.
At the end.
Yeah, well, that's a big sort of Fangoria tribute.
Yeah,
and Fangoria was a hugely important magazine to me when I was growing up, as was Starburst and Cinefex. But anyway, my point being that my kids don't get... The only person who's being punished for a moral reason is Moses, and that's what the whole story is about. The other kids just die in quite a random, unmotivated way. Because I didn't want to do that Stalk and Slash thing, really. You see, there's another influence on this film, is all those... I've tried to put in somehow everything I liked about everything I've ever seen for, like, 30 years.
But that's a classic. It's not just kind of slasher films. That's a classic of monster movies as well.
That people sort of deserve to die in one way or another, or the narrative gives the character a reason to... It's very pronounced in the early Friday the 13th films, not so much later on.
Yeah. No, I think sort of. I mean, it works in two different ways. You either have those movies where you want to cheer who's getting killed. So obviously, Hi-Hat's getting killed here is a big sort of a moment of applause because he's one of the bad guys.
Now this is a Creepshow moment. I'm a big fan of Creepshow, and in fact, did you come and see? We went to the Sitges.
Yeah, we did.
Film
we saw
Festival.
It in Sitges.
We saw, yeah, we watched a sort of tribute show of Creepshow together, Edgar and I. But
is the missing jaw in Creepshow, or is there
one? No, it's not. It's not a specific reference to a shot, but that kind of 80s in-camera splatter.
Yeah,
I really enjoy, and I remember Creepshow in the UK was a 15, and it was one of the goriest films I'd ever seen at the time, and it felt like seeing an X. And it had so many, you know, the sequence where the guy, all the cockroaches explode out of the guy at the end.
The creature in the cage pouring
the
at people with like
amazing
sort of,
the crate,
yeah, exactly.
The section called the crate.
I remember it has some particularly gory, yeah, like sort of claw wounds.
Yeah, I mean, the other big one for me, gore wise, was Day of the Dead.
Yeah,
that was I think a 15 in the UK, and it was. I think it still is possibly one of the most graphic, brilliant. It's Savini, isn't it? It's one
oh, yeah.
of the most brilliant graphic.
I think that's the kind of the touchstone for that kind of prosthetic gore, and it's kind of untopped. It still looks really good. I think that's in the same way that you were saying about the mid '80s is where practical effects reached their, you know.
And there's a grand.
What else happened in 1985? Think about it.
What.
First ever CGI in a movie. What was that in?
Well, it was in Joe Cornish and the Pyramid of Fear.
Young Sherlock Holmes and the Pyramid of Fear, which is the UK title, not the US title. It was just called Young Sherlock Holmes.
I auditioned for that film, listeners. I thought I was a shoo-in to play Sherlock, but I didn't get the role in the end.
You look a little bit like the guy who played Sherlock.
I've got the long nose. That's all you need to be Holmes.
I'm sure with today, but that what's interesting is that's the, you know, 1985 is where you had your first CGI in a movie.
Right. Beginning of the beginning. But the thing I was going to say is that I love that Grand Guignol feel to 80s gore. That's a sort of sideshow, kind of circus, kind of Herschel Gordon Lewis feel to it, where you expect to see it in a theatre and everyone to go, whoa! Whereas these days it seems to be more about torture and sadism and, you know, there used to be just a fun, fakezoid, splattery joy to horror.
And also those films as well, they had more of a sense.
Not that there aren't brilliant movies about tortury stuff, which there are, but for me there are too many that aren't so good.
But I know exactly what you mean about Day of the Dead. is you cheer the loudest for the person that you like the least.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of, it's disturbing to see, you know, Leon get it. Because he's kind of, you know,
he's a good kid.
He's one of the nicer ones. But yeah. Hi-Hats is like an applause-worthy moment.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of that comes from EC Comics, doesn't it? Like, because the EC Comics, usually they're nasty pieces of work and you can't wait for them to get their comeuppance.
Mm.
So in a lot of, like...
But they're very moral. That's the interesting thing with horror, isn't it? It's often much more moral than people give it credit for. I always think that about The Exorcist. It's probably old news, but people thinking... The Exorcist being a profoundly religious and moral film, really. And you've got to believe in God to be scared by The Exorcist.
Because... Yeah.
And it's the same for a lot of horror. And particularly Attack the Block is, so at least the ambition was to be extremely moral, to show that the consequences of a mistake by this character. So you know, often people who think that horror films are kind of just sort of gratuitous and indulgent are kind of missing the point sometimes.
Well, it's probably because there's enough of them that are.
Yeah. Well, it feels that way more now.
Yeah.
I'm kind of talking about how it used to be. I don't know, it feels as if people in the past, I'm sure it's not true, but the movies I loved anyway had a balance between, they just had a joy and an integrity to them, weirdly. They weren't just all out, let's see what we can do to freak people out. Even Texas Chainsaw Massacre, that had that really strong, sinister atmosphere around it. You felt like you were watching a snuff movie when you saw it. It's all off camera, isn't it?
And
it's
It's
brilliantly crafted. The good ones you don't actually see that much.
Yeah, I think that's... I think that's also, what's really great in this is I think you actually... You get a lot of impact, and this is partly a budget thing, but it's also in the construction. But you don't see the creatures that much, and so it actually makes them more exciting when they do appear. Like, I love the shot earlier on where the monster is poking its head around the corner.
Huh.
It's great, and it's just, like, such a, you know...
That's quite a Henson moment.
Oh, in what sense? Just
Because that's actually totally in camera, that shot. It's just,
right.
It's just the performer in the... And it's the way the fur on his chin swings as it comes round.
Oh, it's great.
It's a little like the Snuffleupagus attacks. Do you remember the Snuffleupagus?
Of course. The Snuffleupagus who...
The invisible creature on...
Although then they've changed it. He's real now.
Oh, and does he... Because in my day on Sesame Street...
He was an imaginary friend.
Yeah, he was imaginary. And we would see him. The brilliantly clever thing was we would see him, but none of the characters would.
But in their kind of PC drive on Sesame Street, Snuffleupagus is now real. The imaginary friend thing is considered...
Because they think it might screw up kids' brains.
Well, I think sort of there's a lot of, you know, like sort of... This is another conversation for another time. But I think partly to do with, you know, like imaginary friends being sort of a bad thing and...
Really?
You know, like, well, you know, like just... or people saying, don't tell your parents about me.
Oh, so secrets.
Yeah, secrets, not good.
Fair enough, but...
Don't tell mummy about the big elephant. The big literally the big elephant in the room.
No, that's true. But you know, the other thing we wanted to do is not hold back the creature till the very end, because I enjoy movies like Gremlins, obviously, is a massive... is one of my favourite films ever, and Joe Dante, one of my favourite directors ever, and also Starship Troopers, one of my favourite films.
Oh, that's got great monsters.
And there's a thing about not withholding the creature for the whole movie, about, you know, like two-thirds of the way and just going, okay, we know what it looks like, let's try and make a thing out of quantity now rather than withholding the design.
No, I remember when I was a kid and I watched Gremlins, and there's that shot, a stop-motion shot, I think, where you see all the gremlins running down the street. It's after the swimming pool bit.
Yeah.
I remember watching that and being so excited. It's like, and I think you get a similar vibe at the end here. What I mean is, you show your monster early, but then it's not overdone. Like, and I know that's partly a budget thing, but I think that's also just in the construction of the script. But then to have, as we got coming up very shortly, shots with many of them, which is amazing. I mean, to watch these scenes at the end knowing that there's only two suits is pretty impressive.
Yeah, that was just cut, copy, paste. And again, that's a technique we tested very early when we shot the first test. We shot one creature in a corridor, and then we just kept the camera rolling and repositioned him, and it was instantly worked, and we got quite excited.
What was the toughest scene to shoot?
The toughest scene to shoot was that van attack sequence.
Oh, yeah.
Because we were covering so many different... You know, you had Sam in the back of the van. It was not just the sight lines, but it was a combination of everything. It was creatures and fireworks. Different multiple points of view. Moses in the cell, Sam in the back of the van, the kids on the bridge, the two coppers. We were shooting in a residential street where we were annoying neighbours.
You have that story about the lady.
Yeah.
It's worth recording for the commentary.
Did I say it in any of the other commentaries? I don't think there was a woman that just strode onto set in the middle of the van attack and shouted, take your tuppence halfpenny film and fuck off. And I don't think anyone said tuppence halfpenny in London for 25 years. So my theory is she was a ghost. We were hassled by a ghost.
She was a ghost who was haunting the set of Passport to Pimlico in 1947.
One nice person, one of the very first screenings we had of this film, one nice guy came out of it and said it reminded... He said he thought it was an old-school child empowerment film, which really pleased me. And he mentioned a movie called Hue and Cry, which is a very early Ealing movie, and an amazing film all set in London just post-war about a gang of kids who thwart a smuggling ring. Just thought I'd mention that because I recommend Hue and Cry. I'd never seen it before, and it's a wonderful film. And it has the same sense of the idea that if young people got it together and took action about something, how they could be a very effective force. You know?
Well, we bonded over our love of, and we both appeared in productions of...
Of Bugsy Malone.
Bugsy Malone.
Yeah.
Did Bugsy Malone have any impact on this film?
Definitely. And in fact, one or two critics, talk about that.
That's great.
But absolutely. And I made a super conscious decision not to try and use actors who were close to the age of the characters in the script, because whenever I see movies about young people... And they're played by people in their 20s wearing very thick foundation, I get the willies a little bit.
But you know what's funny is that watching Bugsy Malone as like a six-year-old when I first saw it,
I'm not aware
of the joke.
No, I just think seem really mature and sophisticated.
Yeah, this seems exactly. Amazing, yeah. So it's not actually, I'm aware of that joke.
Oh, I love that because again, it's a wish fulfillment thing, and it's important for me to have. You know, these actors are all 16, 17 when we shot, but we cast them. We cast the most baby-faced kids we could find, so they felt. And it's important to the story as well, because, of course, if these characters were 18, for me, they would be much less sympathetic. But when...
That's a great show of the monster.
Cool. When this is all, again, Dean Egg's work and Fido, who are a brilliant European effects company who did some amazing work for us as well. But yeah, that just that thing about, for me, because the character is 15,
yeah,
that for me mitigates, it makes him a little more sympathetic and a little easier to not necessarily forgive, but certainly to understand why he's done what he did at the beginning of the film, because he's just a confused kid in a bad place, but also a kid that's capable of doing heroic things, as we see here. But it's supposed to be ambiguous, and again, this is another John Carpenter thing, and a thing I remember from the 70s and 80s, where heroes weren't quite so clear-cut. There was
Napoleon Wilson in Assault on Precinct 13 is a murderer.
Absolutely. You never hear the details of his crime or why he did it. He never tries to apologise for it. You know, even Deckard in Blade Runner is a very, very tortured character. You know, Scarface, Han Solo before he shot first. there's loads. Vin Diesel in Pitch Black. Snake Plissken in Escape from New York is, you know, on death row, isn't he? Or he's a prisoner at the beginning. So there's a big history of ambiguity in lead characters that I wanted to try and tap into here. And for me, it's missing or you don't get it so much nowadays, because I think studios are so keen for films to appeal to everybody that they become a bit nervous of
anything
that's potentially unsympathetic. So you tend to get these very identikit characters who are usually dads with young children or beautiful new wives who get kidnapped or something.
Yeah, or you have a very kind of long intro into why they're bad. Like, so
yeah, and then
something like kind of Con Air with Nicolas Cage, they have to have a long prologue explaining exactly why he's in prison.
Right. And for me, it was always interesting to start with a character who was morally ambiguous, and the film just wouldn't exist without that. It could never have been a film about a sweet misunderstood gang, even though it is a bit. It's important to me that they do bad because it kind of does happen, but the film's all about trying to contextualize that one action.
I always like the fact that you see Granny Magnet so late in the film.
Yeah, well, that was another thing, you know, and that's similar to the design of the monsters, and that was a very early thought, that the kids themselves start silhouetted and two-dimensional like the creatures.
And then you start to reveal more about
and
how young
the
they
are.
As
the movie goes on, their lairs become peeled away, like, both in terms of character and in terms of costume, even. Obviously, they start with their faces masked, their hoods up, and now we're looking at Moses, you know, in one sweatshirt and his hat, so you can see his face properly, and he's become a proper character. And yeah, and Pest has two hoods and a hat and three pairs of trousers at the beginning of the film. And now here he is, and you can see his hair, and you can see he's just a kid, and you can see that, you know, he's loved. And it's interesting, isn't it, that in my mind, that mugging at the beginning of the film is the first time they've ever done it.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And they're there to support Moses, but they probably think he's being stupid. Should I have said that? Should I have had a scene where they go, oh, let's do our first...
No,
because
I think I think the thing is, you know, in terms of the films that you're referencing and what a lot of films don't do is there's that kind of writing rule about, like, start late and leave early. It's kind of like, start as late as you can and you know, like, leave some questions unanswered or answer the questions during the movie. Don't have to
but you
explain
do,
anything
you
at the
do
start.
Take a, you do take a, for me, an exciting and thrilling and cool risk by doing that. And you see the way that movies like The Warriors were received at the time.
Yeah.
And if you look at The Warriors...
Well, basically pulled from theatres, The Warriors.
Yeah, and if you read about the fuss that The Warriors caused, or indeed a movie like The Clockwork Orange caused at the time... If you read about that now, it seems ridiculous, doesn't it? It's like, and you watch those movies now, you know, The Warriors was never intended to be a present-day story, so much so that when Walter Hill reissued it, he reinstated the science fictional context.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this is...
Let's talk a little bit about the sending, because this to me actually sort of feels... very, like, much like a sort of... this is the first time that Moses smiles, isn't it?
Yeah, this is the first time that... Well, no, it's not the first time he smiles, but it's the first sincere, properly motivated, real smile that isn't to do with pride or showing out or all those corrupting influences that he's had. It's just an honest young kid who feels a sense of self-worth for the first time.
Yeah.
Smiling, yeah. So
now, what I don't know if you talked about this on the other commentaries, but like not just with the cast, but also from audiences who've seen it. What are the reactions you've had from people of the age of the characters?
The vast majority flip out; they love it. I don't know. I don't want to go into individual detail, but it gets a very strong response. You know, they really dig it, and I think the thing is that. People, you know, who live in these kinds of environments don't see themselves in movies very often.
Yeah.
And, they dig it. They understand that the whole thing's larger than life and it's a sort of fable. And, yeah, they really like it. But you know what? We're recording this commentary on the day that the film's opens in the UK, right?
Well, let's get on Twitter and see what somebody, UCG in Glasgow thought when they came out of the 11 a.m.
We're actually we're recording this commentary on the 11th of May, 2011, and in fact it's about noon. Is it now? No, it's just before lunch. So the first screenings, the first public paying screenings of this film, are about to happen or happening as we speak.
I know we don't want to say anything that will get us in that make us look silly later, like that later on that day cinema was abolished.
What were you doing on the day that Shaun of the Dead was released? Do you remember?
During the day?
Yeah.
Oh, no idea.
Maybe. Do you remember how you felt?
pretty nervous. Like, I don't know. I just was kind of relieved that it was out there. But it was. I remember going to the. I saw it, and I've never really done this since. I'm not one of those people. There are a lot of directors who go around all the cinemas,
right?
But
Shaun like of in the disguise Dead, and sit in the back to see how people.
Shaun of the Dead. I saw it twice, once in Camden and once in Ealing on the first weekend, with maybe cinemas that were half full, slightly less than half full, and it got a very loud response from the people who were there.
Hmm.
But it wasn't full. And then the next week I saw it in a cinema that was full, the Electric, and that was a much more arms folded, not so loud response. So it's funny, sort of like, and obviously, like, over the last 10 years, I've really, 10 years, 7 years since Shaun of the Dead, felt the love for the film. But it's funny that it's, you know, like, trying to find that perfect screening is difficult, you know. So yeah, I've always been too chicken afterwards with Hot Fuzz and Scott Pilgrim. I've been too chicken to actually attend a public screening. Quentin Tarantino, God bless him, he'll go and watch it with three people in the audience and a full house. He'll just, you know, I think he takes it upon himself to watch everything. You're not going to go around cinemas, though, are you?
I don't know, listeners. You know, as I say, today's the day the film comes out. Some people on the crew are going to wander around the London theatres and see what the response is. I'm still undecided. I might just go home and have a lovely bath with some scented candles and rose petals and a little bit of Sibelius on the radio. I might just watch other movies. I think that's what I might do, just watch.
Go home and watch Chris's.
Go home and watch Chris's, yeah. Or what else could I do? I don't know. What should I do? Or I could just stand outside cinemas and talk to people as they come out.
Well, listen, I think that was
fun, man.
That was good. I think we covered a lot of ground, didn't we?
Yeah. Thanks for listening, listeners.
I know. I hope that was useful. I'm sorry that, like, a couple of times, I'm sorry I didn't know the name of the wheelie people in Return to Oz.
How dare you?
My geek cred has gone down massively.
The wheelie people.
They had a specific name. I remember that much.
Taunton and the Wheelies.
We're not cheating. We're not getting straight on the laptops to check, because we could do that.
You can fact check.
We could have stopped the tape and gone back, but no, we're just trying to keep it real. Me and Cornish.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, folks.
I'd like to say on record, since I'm here in front of the chair, I'd like to say that I think Joe Cornish, my friend and colleague, I think you did a fantastic job with your debut, and I'm very proud to be involved.
Thank you, sir. Well, thank you for being my exec producer. And thanks for all your support over the years. That's it.
That's it. Let's go.
Bye.
Bye.